Word 47. Paragon. P-A-R-A-G-O-N. A model of excellence. Perfect example. Paragon applies to a person or thing so excellent that it serves as a model or example of perfection. The inventor Thomas Alva Edison is a paragon of American ingenuity. In her Camelot days, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was considered a paragon of beauty and style. The Gettysburg Address is a paragon of forceful, eloquent speechwriting. A paragon is a model of excellence, a perfect example. Word 48. Analogous. A-N-A-L-O-G-O-U-S. Similar. Akin. Comparable. Corresponding partially. Sharing some aspects of form, function, or content. An analogy is a partial similarity, likeness, or resemblance that allows for a comparison between things. You can draw an analogy between the human brain and a computer, between the human heart and a mechanical pump, or between an airplane and a bird. When we see an analogy between two things, we say they are analogous, similar but not entirely alike, comparable in some respects. Analogous does not apply to things that are identical. For example, brains and computers and birds and airplanes differ markedly in all but a few ways, but in those ways, they are analogous. When things are analogous, they share certain features or particulars. They are similar enough to form the basis for a comparison. If you say your company's management style is analogous to Japanese management style, you mean the styles are alike in some respects, but not in others. If you tell a coworker that your job descriptions are analogous, you mean they are similar, comparable, alike in certain ways. Word 49. Diurnal. D-I-U-R-N-A-L. Daily. Recurring each day. Performed or happening in the course of a day. Diurnal comes from the Latin diurnus, belonging to or lasting for a day. The ocean's tides and the rotation of the earth are diurnal. Their cycles are completed in the course of a day. At work, your diurnal duties are the tasks you perform every day. If your coworker Joanne complains every day about not getting a raise, that's her diurnal complaint. Perhaps if Joanne made listening to Verbal Advantage part of her diurnal routine, she might eventually get that raise and get off your back. Diurnal is also used to mean active during the day, as opposed to nocturnal, active during the night. Word 50. Pretext. P-R-E-T-E-X-T. An excuse. Ostensible reason or motive. Professed purpose. Pretext comes through the Latin pretextum, an ornament, from the verb pretexere, to pretend, literally to weave in front. By derivation, a pretext is a front, a facade, something used for cover. As the Century Dictionary puts it, a pretext is that which is assumed as a cloak or means of concealment, something under cover of which a true purpose is hidden. Tyrannical leaders often invent pretexts for invading or declaring war on other countries. Irresponsible employees will invent pretexts for not coming to work. A supervisor who hates an employee's guts may try to come up with a pretext for firing the person. A pretext is an excuse, an ostensible reason designed to hide the real reason.
Let's review the 10 key words you've just learned. This time, I'm going to give you the review word, followed by three words or phrases, and you decide which of those three answer choices comes nearest the meaning of the review word. Are you ready? Let's begin. Does cursory mean unnecessary, offensive, or superficial? Cursory means hasty and superficial, done quickly with little attention to detail. Does vacillate mean to lubricate, to waver, or to deceive? Vacillate means to waver, show uncertainty, hesitate in making up one's mind. Does clement mean gracious, fair, or mild? Clement means mild, temperate, not severe or extreme. Clement may also mean merciful, lenient, inclined to forgive. Does lucrative mean profitable, prudent, or unethical? Lucrative means profitable, money-making, producing wealth. Does allocate mean to place, to assign, or to support? Allocate means to assign, designate, earmark, set aside for a specific purpose. Does reconcile mean to examine closely, to deduce from evidence, or to make friendly again? Reconcile means to make friendly again, settle, resolve, bring into harmony or agreement. Is a paragon a reproduction, a model of excellence, or the highest point? A paragon is a model of excellence, perfect example. Does analogous mean similar, identical, or out of proportion? Analogous means similar, comparable, alike in some respects. Does diurnal mean daily, occasional, or constant? Diurnal means daily, recurring each day. Is a pretext an introduction, an opportunity, or an excuse? A pretext is an excuse, ostensible reason, a professed purpose designed to hide the real purpose. By the way, did you keep track of your answers in this quiz? How about for each of the review quizzes for this level? Review is the key to retaining the words you learn, and as the words in the program get more difficult, the amount of time you spend reviewing will determine whether you will fix those words in your vocabulary for life or forget them by tomorrow morning. So remember, be sure to listen to each set of keyword discussions until you can answer at least 7 of the questions in the corresponding quiz correctly. That concludes the review for this section and for Level 2.
In the introduction to Level 2, we discussed how you can use newspapers and magazines, otherwise known as periodical literature, to build your vocabulary. Now let's talk about how to get you reading more books. In recent years, many busy professionals have begun listening to tape-recorded books while commuting or driving to and from appointments. That's certainly better than reading 2 books a year, the national average for college-educated adults, or reading no books at all. Listening to a book on tape is also convenient and can save you valuable time. However, when it comes to vocabulary building, audiobooks won't help you very much. It's too easy to concentrate just on getting the gist of what's being said and ignore the words you don't know. On top of that, you may be hearing mispronunciations and absorbing them without realizing it. What it comes down to is this. If you currently read fewer than 6 books a year, 1 every 2 months, then you need to rediscover the wonderful world of books and make recreational reading a part of your life. Here's how you can start. Read your local newspaper's book reviews or subscribe to a magazine or out-of-town paper that reviews books. Not only will that help you find books you will enjoy, but the reviews themselves are often an excellent source of expressive words. Another way to get yourself on a regular schedule of reading is to join a book club. where you are obligated to order a certain number of books each year. That can be an incentive to finish the books you start and also to read more widely. The next time you order a book or browse in a bookstore, be daring. Let your curiosity get the best of you. Try something on a subject that you don't know much about, but that piques your interest. If you have trouble making that leap, how about reading a biography of someone you respect or admire? Also, let's not forget the value of good fiction. Ask a friend or someone in the office to recommend a good novel. If you like it, try reading other books by the same author. Now, I should caution you that when it comes to fiction, I don't put much stock in thrillers, romances, westerns, and war novels. With the exception of mysteries, which are generally written by better-than-average writers for a higher-caliber audience, most genre or category fiction provides plenty of diversion but little edification. These days, there are few popular novelists who truly know their craft. I'll never forget the time I heard a radio interview with a best-selling author of westerns. When the interviewer asked him to explain a few unusual words he had found in the book, the author gave the wrong definitions. What can you expect to learn from reading a book by someone like that? Finally, I encourage you to take advantage of the public library. Becoming a regular patron of your local library is the simplest and least expensive way to broaden your knowledge of the world. When was the last time you checked out a book? If you can't remember, then you're overdue for a visit. Go down and get reacquainted with the Dewey Decimal System. And if you have kids, take them with you and introduce them to the children's section. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by making the quest for new words, good books, and useful knowledge an integral part of your personal and professional life. So now that I've told you what to read, let me say a few things about how to read. Here are five principles to follow. Principle number one. Read outside of your specialty or area of expertise. It may sound strange, but most of what you read should not be directly related to your work. By all means, keep up with what's going on in your profession, but don't limit your reading to subjects you already know well. Are you familiar with Tom Peters? Peters is the author of the best-selling management guide On Excellence. He also writes a syndicated column with the same title. In one of those columns, he discussed his strategies for making learning in the workplace a continuous exercise, strategies he felt would work even for those whose schedules are crammed from dawn till dusk. Peters agrees that you should avoid reading too much in areas where you are already reasonably well-versed. The most effective professionals, he says, know their own turf cold, to be sure, but their special added value for clients and colleagues is their ability to draw upon analogous ideas from disparate fields to form analyses about problems closer to home. Not only does Peters make an important point, but in making it, he also uses two fine words, analogous, which we discussed as word 48 of level 2, and disparate. As you now know, analogous means similar, comparable, alike in certain ways. Do you know what disparate means? Let me repeat how Peters used it, and you try to deduce the meaning from context. Their special added value for clients and colleagues is their ability to draw upon analogous ideas from disparate fields to form analyses about problems closer to home. As you probably deduced from the context, disparate means different, distinct, having incompatible elements or natures. Occasionally, you will hear educated people pronounce the word disparate, with the accent on the second syllable. This relatively recent variant has made its way into the dictionaries and is now standard. Careful speakers, however, use the traditional and preferred pronunciation, which places the stress on the first syllable, disparate. Let's move on now to my second principle for effective reading. Go for variety. Remember the old saying, variety is the spice of life? To paraphrase that adage, that's A-D-A-G-E, variety is also the spice of reading. With each book you read, try a different subject, or choose a subject you want to know more about and make a 3 or 4 book study of it. Alternating between nonfiction and fiction is also a good way to keep things interesting. And remember, in selecting your reading material, don't let yourself be manipulated by other people's tastes. You don't have to have all the bestsellers or all the classics on your shelf. You're not reading to keep up with the Joneses. You're reading to become a more informed, articulate, and successful person. Principle number 3. Read what you enjoy. This is very important. You won't learn much from a book you force yourself to read. If something doesn't hold your interest, put it down and read something else. Reading shouldn't be a chore. It should be a pleasure. Principle number 4. Read with a dictionary. If your dictionary is in the other room, it's too easy to get lazy and say, the heck with it. When your dictionary's right beside you, you can look up an unfamiliar word immediately. You don't have to lug your dictionary around wherever you go, either. Every educated person should own at least 2 dictionaries. Not the paperback variety, either, mind you. Too many of the words you look up won't be in there. 1 dictionary should be on your desk at the office, or wherever you do most of your writing and paperwork. The other dictionary should be at home, within reach of the books and magazines you are currently reading. As you read, underline or highlight words you don't know and words you aren't entirely sure of, and look them up. If you don't like to interrupt the flow of your reading, simply jot the words down on a bookmark or a slip of paper, along with the page number, and look them up at the end of your reading session. Don't forget to write down the number of the page on which the word appears, so you can find the word again and study how it is used in context. I don't work for any dictionary publishers, and I'm not trying to sell you a bill of goods here. I can vouch from experience and unequivocally guarantee that promptly checking the dictionary definition of unfamiliar words will greatly improve your reading comprehension and do wonders for your vocabulary. And now for principle number 5. Don't cheat yourself. You should never read around words you don't know or that you think you can figure out from context. Bypassing a word you think you know because you've seen it once or twice before, or because you can figure out what the sentence means, is a bad habit, one that in the long run can be detrimental to your vocabulary. Unfortunately, most people read around difficult words without realizing it. I have even had the disturbing experience of meeting people who actually express pride that they can discern the meaning of a passage without knowing the meanings of the words it contains. That, I'm afraid to say, is a delusion. Being able to read around words is not a sign of intelligence. It is a sign of laziness. Furthermore, the consequences of guessing what a word means can be quite serious. First, you cheat yourself out of a precise knowledge of the language. And second, because the margin for error is so great, more often than not, you will make the wrong guess. You know what you are doing then? Building a vocabulary filled with incorrect definitions. That kind of vocabulary leads straight to bad usage and embarrassment. So, you see what I mean when I say that reading around words is nothing but a colossal waste of time. Also, the words you read around are often the words at the very border of your vocabulary, the ones you are most receptive to learning, and the ones you most need to check in a dictionary right away. They are the words you could pick up rapidly with a minimum of effort. However, if you skip over them, they remain locked forever in your passive vocabulary. Then you never extend the boundary of your vocabulary and pave the way for learning more difficult words. So that's why I say, don't cheat yourself when it comes to using the dictionary to abet your vocabulary development. If you have the slightest doubt about what a word means or how the writer used it, look it up. If you find that the definition you had in mind is the correct one, that's cause for celebration. You have just added a new word or a new definition of a familiar word to your permanent, active vocabulary. Now, before we move on to level 3, I'd like to take a moment to tell you about 2 special techniques you can use to continue building your vocabulary after you've completed the Verbal Advantage program. They require a modest investment of your time and energy, but they are extremely effective. You're probably familiar with the first technique, the classic flashcard method. It's as simple as it sounds. All you do is write every new word you find in reading or hear in conversation on a 3x5-inch index card. On one side, write the word, and on the other side, write the dictionary definition. You should also note how the word is pronounced, and perhaps include a sample phrase or sentence that illustrates how the word is used. Carry as many of these word cards with you as is convenient, and take them out and test yourself several times a day for a few days, until you have memorized the meanings of all the words and feel comfortable with them. Then file the cards for future reference and start in on a new batch. My father used the flashcard method while attending the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, probably the most prestigious and exclusive conservatory in the country. He knew that the trade-off for training 10 hours a day to become a top-flight professional musician was missing out on a well-rounded, liberal arts college education. To make up for it, he took summer classes at the University of Chicago, read widely on his own, kept a record of any unfamiliar words he came across, and tested himself rigorously with the flashcards. Entirely on his own, he acquired an excellent vocabulary, which undoubtedly was an important factor in his later becoming the principal harpist of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra in New York City, a position he held for 38 years until his retirement in the 1980s. Perhaps intuitively, my father understood that a powerful vocabulary will help you achieve more in life, even if your career doesn't appear to require strong verbal skills. In short, I believe my father is living proof of Johnson O'Connor's theory that whatever your occupation, the level of your vocabulary is closely linked to the level of your professional success. Now for the second vocabulary-building technique, which I call the personal dictionary. With this method, you simply record all the new words you come across on a legal pad or in a notebook. If you have a computer at home, you can start a personal dictionary file, which is easy to update and keep in alphabetical order. You can arrange your personal dictionary in any number of ways: to show the words you've learned each month, to show the words you've learned from each book you've read, or to show which words you've learned from conversing with friends and business associates. However you choose to organize it, your personal dictionary is your individual record of progress, a measure of how much you've read, heard, and absorbed. To sum up what we've discussed so far, carefully listening to and reviewing each level of verbal advantage will put your vocabulary development into high gear. But if you want to keep your verbal skills humming along smoothly after you finish the program, you need to read more, use your dictionary, keep track of the words you learn, and review them frequently. And with that unambiguous tirade, we come to the end of Level 2. Be sure to review this level so you'll be fully prepared to take on the more challenging words ahead. And while you're at it, maybe you should also find your dictionary and give it a thorough dusting. It wouldn't hurt to start consulting it while you're listening to the rest of the Verbal Advantage program. Welcome to Level 3 of Verbal Advantage. Let me begin by asking you an important question. Do you know the name of your dictionary? Think about it for a moment. Can you remember the full name? Here's why I ask. In the many professional workshops I've taught, I've found that most people haven't the slightest idea what the name of their dictionary is. Webster's, they tell me, and I shoot back, "Did you know that the name Webster's is in the public domain, and there are well over a dozen dictionaries called Webster's on the market? Which Webster's do you own?" Most people don't know the name of their dictionary, or who publishes it. They may know if it's old or new, but they generally don't know if it's abridged or unabridged, or what its strengths and weaknesses are. That has always struck me as strange. Would you buy a car without knowing the name of the company that made it, or a tool without knowing how to use it? Most people agree that a dictionary is an essential resource, one that everyone should own, but they rarely take advantage of what it has to offer. The average college-educated person may use a dictionary once or twice a month. In my workshops, I've found that secretaries use a dictionary once or twice a week. Their bosses, on the other hand, the managers, executives, and professionals, may crack the binding of a word book as infrequently as once or twice a year. As I'm sure you can guess by now, that spells disaster for anyone who wants to use the language with precision. Part of achieving the verbal advantage is developing what I call the dictionary habit. I can assure you, it is a beneficial addiction. No harm will come to you from using a dictionary to increase your knowledge of words. You should own at least two dictionaries, keep one at work and one at home, and make an effort to consult them regularly. Look up any challenging words you come across in reading, especially those you think you know and have been reading around, as we discussed earlier. You should also use the dictionary when you write. Let me underscore that last point. If you write without consulting a dictionary, all sorts of embarrassing errors can slip by into the finished product. A report, proposal, or memo in which words are misused or misspelled is irritating to read, and we all know that when it comes to making the right impression, even a little irritation can damage your credibility. I once edited a book on business leadership by a prominent management consultant who has a doctoral degree. Throughout the book, the author used the phrase, a decisional criteria. Does anything about that phrase strike you as objectionable? If you're thinking, that sounds like jargon, you're right. It's an example of specialized, unnecessarily technical language. Beyond that objection, I suspect that most readers would find the phrase innocuous. Now, there's a fine word, innocuous. I-N-N-O-C-U-O-U-S. It means harmless, not producing any ill effect, as an innocuous drug or an innocuous remark. But back to the phrase, a decisional criteria. It may seem innocuous, but in fact it contains two serious errors. First, the word criteria is the plural of criterion. A criteria is wrong. You must say, this is my criterion, and these are my criteria. With a quick peek into a dictionary, the author could have corrected the mistake. In checking the definition of criterion, he also could have avoided the second blunder, redundancy. For even if the phrase were corrected to a decisional criterion, it would still be redundant. A criterion is a standard on which a judgment or decision is based. Decisional criterion repeats the idea conveyed by the meaning of criterion alone. Translate the author's words into clear and simple English, and you have the ridiculous phrase, a standard for decision-making that pertains to making decisions. So you see, writing isn't easy. And even well-educated people can make mistakes if they don't take the time to examine their diction, their choice of words, and check their usage and spelling in a dictionary. Don't delegate this task to a secretary or assistant. You will learn a great deal from editing your own writing. You will avoid the embarrassment of turning out a shoddy product. And you will save yourself the time spent rectifying things down the line. The more paperwork you have, the easier it is to overlook small but significant errors. Therefore, it's essential that you make time to revise everything you write, not just the reports and proposals, which usually get the most attention, but also your everyday letters and memoranda. Here's something helpful you can do your next day on the job. Ask a coworker whose language skills you trust to look over what you have written before it goes out the door. In asking this favor, you can offer to return it, and so begin to set up an editorial system that can wind up improving the quality of writing in the entire office or department. A second and even third pair of eyes never hurt a piece of writing. In fact, every book, before it gets bound and published, is scrutinized by at least four persons: the author, editor, copy editor, and proofreader. Even then, a few errors still may appear in the finished product. Nobody's perfect, but the more conscientious you are about checking your writing, and the more help you can get correcting it, the better off you will be. In the long run, it will pay off in many ways, from making the right impression to satisfying clients or customers to getting others to understand your point of view. So, now that you are going to develop the dictionary habit, the next question to resolve is, which dictionary should I use? Although every dictionary has its strengths and weaknesses, for general purposes, just about any current hardcover dictionary will do. Paperback dictionaries, which are sometimes called pocket dictionaries, have limited vocabularies and are best used for checking spelling and pronunciation. Hardcover dictionaries come in two sizes, abridged and unabridged. Unabridged dictionaries contain up to 4 times as many words as abridged dictionaries, but they can be bulky and cumbersome, and unless you have a large desk, they are not well suited for use at the office. However, I am adamant, and even obstinate, in my belief that every self-respecting, word-conscious person should own an unabridged dictionary because of the breadth of information it contains. The best place for one is on a table or counter in the living room or family room, where you can lay it open and thumb through it easily. There are 2 good unabridged dictionaries currently on the market. The Random House Dictionary of the English Language, 2nd edition, published by Random House, and the American Heritage Dictionary, 3rd edition, published by Houghton Mifflin. If you'd like to learn more about word histories, you may want to acquire the Oxford English Dictionary, which is available in an affordable, compact, micrographic edition. The OED, as that great work is affectionately called, focuses chiefly on the origin and development of words. In the office, most people use an abridged desktop dictionary, usually called a college or collegiate edition. Desktop dictionaries are easy to handle and contain most of the linguistic information you will need on the job. Of the many on the market today, the 3 most reputable are Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, 10th edition, published by Merriam-Webster, the Random House Webster's College Dictionary, published by Random House, and Webster's New World Dictionary, 3rd College Edition, published by Simon & Schuster. Now I'd like to share with you a few tips on how to read a dictionary. In other words, how to get the most out of what it contains. The dictionary is an extraordinarily detailed and comprehensive source of knowledge about language, a 1-volume reference library. Not only does it define words, it also shows how they're pronounced, it explains where they came from, and it provides information on grammar, usage, and style. When you look up a word, the first thing the entry tells you is the thing people most often overlook, pronunciation. Don't skip over the pronunciation to get to the definition. The task of learning how to use a word begins with knowing how to say it right. If you have trouble deciphering some of the symbols used to indicate pronunciation, don't worry. I'll be giving you some help with that later in the program.
To continue with Level 3 and Word 1, please fast forward the tape and go to Side 9.